relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story. Welcome, dear friends, to this special edition. It's our new one-on-one with America First, where we give me, because I love the long form, an opportunity to dive deeper on a specific issue, but with one guest who is uniquely positioned to do that, and to get him to introduce, or herself, to introduce themselves to you so you get to know them even better. In the case of the Baron, you know him very well. Not only is he a regular on America First every week, he is also our co-host for our Battle for 1600 podcast, where we've been just documenting everything that's been happening in the MAGA world, and especially, thanks to his phrase, the freight train of audits. But now we get a whole hour with just the Baron. Boris Epstein, welcome to One on One.
It is great to be here. I did my baronial wave.
The baronial wave.
I'm excited to be here and excited to see you in person, my friend. It's wonderful. Not always great to be in the swamp, but it's wonderful to be here with you.
Yeah, you have been hiding out in beautiful locations for several months, Skyping into the show, comrexing into the show, but that's okay. He's got to check into the swamp just to make sure that we're doing all right. Okay, Boris, let's start. For those who just tuned in, just heard about one-to-one, or just stopped the dial where we are right now, what is your story? Who is the Baron? Who is Boris? Where did he come from? And what has he done?
Wow. I love this.
Is that fun?
That is really fun. Well, it was a beautiful day in August 1982. You know, we've had my family and I.
You're so young. Yeah, you are disgustingly young.
Well, it's the hairline belies it. it has been a wonderful and a truly American story, and one that I'm incredibly, incredibly proud of. We came here as immigrants when I was 11. We're Jewish refugees from the former Soviet Union, from Moscow.
From Moscow.
I was born in Moscow. No, Eric Swalwell, President Swalwell, I am not a spy. No, Shifty Shift.
We're going to talk about that later. We're going to talk about Swalwell's embarrassing behavior with you. But let's talk about the Baron.
And we came here when I was 11. It was me, my parents, my dad's mom and dad, and my mom's mom. So the six of us came together to New York, to this beautiful country, and I'll never forget, you know, our first days, and coming from, you know, the rubble of the Soviet Union, that absolutely destroyed and damaged, crush of what socialism and communism left behind, and to see what America was, and this resurgence that you know, really was happening in the early 90s in New York, thanks to Rudy. You know,
so when were you
Giuliani.
Cognizant? When did you start? What age were you aware of what was going on around you? So what age you arrived here?
Came here when I was 11.
So and you so, are you actually you know the contrast.
Oh, 1,000%. I listen, in 91 when I was, you know, I guess 8 years old or going to be 9 years old in August. In I guess I just turned 9. I lived through the attempted coup in Moscow, right?
And we were guys tanks. We're talking about tanks going down the street in Moscow, if you don't remember that.
Like, if you want to see a real insurrection, that's an insurrection.
That's a real insurrection.
Not like a bunch of guys in funny hats sitting in a chair, you know what I mean?
Or walking through, looking at the statues.
And not touching the art or the statues, being very careful. There's tanks, and this is mortars being shot and buildings being shelled in Moscow. So, you know, we lived that. We lived, you know, we had a tiny little cottage, a wooden cottage outside of Moscow. I was there with my grandparents. My parents were in the city. We couldn't talk. You know, the phones were out, and Swan Lake was playing on every, you know, they only had three TV stations.
Gorby was ill.
Yeah, and he was ill in the Caucasus. So, you know, we lived that. We lived what that destruction of the end of the Soviet Union was, and it was very scary on a sort of macro basis, but it was also scary on a micro basis, the crime that took over Moscow. I was worried about my dad coming home at night. I was that little kid looking out the window.
Who were your parents? What did they do?
My parents are both scientists. My dad is an applied math PhD. My mom's a geologist.
So what happened to you?
I guess, here's the explanation. When we came here, my dad ended up working with a company that worked with Princeton University, and then ended up going to was Bell Labs
as a scientist.
The Lucent, as, yeah, and actually, my dad, I'm very proud, helped design 4G and then 5G.
Because, you never said
that. For Verizon, yeah, it's pretty great.
Wow,
yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, so he was telling me about all the things 5G was going to be able to do, even you know while it was being designed. And then my mom, when we got here, you know, not a lot of need for geologists for you know who are just learning English, and when. You know, and my mom is so smart and so entrepreneurial. Your dad's academic and so smart and kind and easygoing. My mom is a fighter, and she will do anything for her family. And she's so driven. And so when we came here,
a woman from the Rodina,
yeah, very much so. We came here. You know, she looked for jobs anywhere. You know, she cleaned toilets at a hospital, right? She tried selling perfume. She looked at everything, and then finally, when we bought our first home in the Princeton area, she talked to the realtor, and you know, in her own English, she said, "You know, so how much money you make?" You know, and you know, figured out, hey, this it is not a bad business. You know,
so that's what she did,
and then she went into real estate business. Now she's one of the biggest real estate professionals in the Princeton area.
No way. And
to those in New Jersey, Anna Shulkina, you want to buy a house in Princeton? She's your woman. Billboards are
what's one. The name of the company?
It's Anna Shulkina Real Estate in Princeton, New Jersey. If you need to buy a house, sell a house anywhere in New Jersey, but specifically Princeton area, she's your woman. She's got a great team with her, and she's been unbelievably successful. And I will tell you, just yesterday, I'm driving down Route 1 coming here. I was driving back to D.C., and I look on the right, and it's a huge billboard with my mom on it.
Are you know? Serious?
And
what did that make you feel?
It made me swell with pride. I was just
that's
so
fabulous.
Unbelievable. Big.
Hope you stopped and photographed it.
Every time. And then I sing a little song because I get so excited. And it's really great. And, you know, mom, so, you know, I think a lot of my entrepreneurial perspective and business perspective does come from that. And then, you know, the politics and the history. My grandfather, my dad's dad, was a history professor.
Right.
I've talked about him a lot. He was a World War II hero.
Yes.
And somebody who had studied the ins and outs of everything from, you know, the Greeks, the Romans, all the way obviously to the current. So I remember even growing up, I was always very interested in history and current affairs, political affairs. And I would sit and talk to grandpa about, you know, what's going on with, you know, the interplay between China and Iran, even in the, you know, in the 90s and the early 2000s. So, a lot of that interest that comes from being very close with my grandfather. And I named my son after my grandfather, which I'm very proud to have done. And you know, people say, well, you know, we'll do it. But then a lot of folks, you know, change the name or they use the first letter. I actually gave my son my grandpa's name. And that's been, you know, a real treasure and a real gift.
So that's their story. That's how you get here as a kid. How does the Baron become the Baron? Let's talk about your professional life.
Well, you know, it has been varied. It has been a very much a curvy road, right? And even currently, you know, if people ask me what I do, and then in the end I come up with some...
You come on my show.
I'm the Baron. That's
the Baron.
What do you do? I said, I'm the Baron.
You better have some business cards sooner or later.
Baron.
The Baron. With
have,
a
you
little
ever,
crown,
have you ever
a little
seen
crown?
My actual business cards?
No. I've only known you for how many years?
Okay. Here is the business card that I give to folks when I say hello.
That is stylish. Guys, for those of you who are not watching, it's just Boris Epstein Esquire. And his details at the back. It's just, it's old school, and it's good stock. It's like,
it's
you know,
stock.
It's quality
stock.
I'm going to keep this
thick,
a little momentum.
It's for you.
Thank you.
So, it's my second favorite business card. First, of course, the White House business card.
Yes.
And this is my second. And the point being, I'm always involved in so many different things. Somebody says, what do you do? You know, I'm a consultant, and, you know, I've got the political. I've got the business. I've got the... you know, the growth and development consulting that I do for companies, the corporate consulting. So, you know, it's been a very, very windy road and an exciting road. I, you know, went to middle school, went to high school in the Princeton area, ended up at Swarthmore College, which was a small abroad school, for a year, and then transferred to Georgetown. I'd always wanted to go to Georgetown School of Foreign Service.
Oh, really?
And ended up going to Georgetown School of Foreign Service, finished that, went to law school, and then just like, you know, every good Jewish law student was going to go be a lawyer. So I got a job on Wall Street at a great firm called Milbank Tweed Hadley McCloy, one of the top old school. No Jews there 40 years ago, but
yeah.
They got some Jews in now. So a really great law firm, but it just was not for me. I just sitting there every single day in bank finance. Just what I knew very quickly, this was not a long term proposition.
So Boris is he's graduated. He's working at a law school, at a law company, a prestigious one. I'm curious because I had a very similar experience. My first job out of college was in the City of London. I was in corporate intelligence, business intelligence, and I detested it. I just detested it. Why wasn't that law firm for you? Or the law work not for you?
I'm sure it's the same thing. Just the mundane nature of it. And frankly, the set schedule of it, right? That, oh, you've got to be here at 9, you're going to be here till 6, or as a lawyer, a lot of times much later than 6. And frankly, I felt like the lawyers were some of the smartest guys, and they also got paid the least. Because, you know, people think, oh, well, corporate lawyer. If you're a corporate lawyer in New York, you're making, especially if you're not a partner, you're making okay money, but it is by no means, a lot of money. And the amount of time you put in, but per hour, you're not doing that great. Yeah. And it really was not for me. I absolutely detested it. So I quickly, within a year, took a sabbatical to be on the McCain campaign.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, a lot of the partners at the law firm were a little surprised because most first-year associates...
Yeah, don't take sabbaticals.
Don't take a sabbatical. I was like, yeah, I'm taking a sabbatical. Like, excuse me?
See you guys. What? So how did that come about? How did you get... an invitation to be on a campaign?
I'd gotten to know a very, very nice woman in New York. Her name's Crystal Kelly Fisher. She was a big backer of John McCain, of Senator McCain, in 2000 and then 2008. And then I literally started helping her phone bank in I think, late 2007. I decided that he was likely to be the nominee. And remember, that was an interesting race. It was Rudy. It was Huckabee. It was Romney for a time, and then it was McCain. But it became kind of obvious toward end of 2007 that McCain was going to be the nominee. And I started helping. I helped in New York while still being in the law firm, and they needed somebody to come to D.C.
Did the bug bite you then?
I'm not going to say that the bug fully bit me, but it definitely interested me. Right? It was exhilarating. Right? I came to D.C. and a week later I was off to Alaska. I was one of the first people on the ground when Governor Palin was named to be the vice presidential nominee, and it was. It was surreal in a lot of ways, I got to know her family, and I handled a lot of the crises that popped up. Sort of called me the fixer. I had a black Taurus and a black leather jacket. I drove around
Boris the fixer.
Boris the fixer. Anchorage, Alaska, and I went to Fairbanks to figure out where her first. Remember, she had this. I think it was Charlie. I think it was Charlie Rose. No, it was Charlie Gibson. He did an interview with her walking along a pipeline. I staffed that, figured out where that was going to be advanced.
And you've done that so many times before.
Oh, a million
staffed
times.
Staffed interviews just, with...
My whole life. Walking. My whole life. I knew exactly what I was doing. Now, and that's the beauty of politics, the beauty of campaigns. It's very much... Somebody told me on that case, it's command and control. If you tell people you're going to know what to do, you know what to do. And if you do it with some level of competency, they're going to keep going to you because there's not a lot of that,
Right.
And all campaigns are a hodgepodge of people who come from all over the place. Some are from the candidate's home state. Others are from the party. Even others are from the current administration, in that case, the Bush administration. It was just a hodgepodge of people and very exciting. So that excitement definitely did bite me. I'm not going to lie to you. And it was a great time, the camaraderie of it. And then the disappointment of loss was tough too, right? In 2008, and that was a tough election. I've said it since I believe in that. You know, we could have had God as president, God as vice president. There's no way you were going to win that election as a Republican. In 2008,
because it's a black president for the Democrats,
and because the worst economic recession in history had just hit. W. Bush was at 20%, and you had a mixed race candidate who really tapped into this belief of people who, by the way, I was just at lunch earlier today, and something that really I've been thinking about and discussed is how quiet and sort of, non-present Obama has been. I mean, people thought when he was president, this is going to be a historic figure that truly is omnipresent throughout his lifetime, right? And he's sort of been missing in action, except for this dumb party that he's going to have, which is just the millionth example of Democrats.
Elitism.
Of elitism and hypocrisy. So that was 2008. We lost. I went back to the law firm. Really couldn't be a lawyer anymore. And then 2009, the law world, I was in bank finance. Not much work going around. So I said, hey, you guys are giving out, packages to leave. And I'll take, I will happily get laid off and take my package. And I was gosh, it was 09. I was 26 years old. Wow. And I thought, oh, I'll get another job just like that. Except it's the worst recession since the Great Depression. Okay. And I was getting married that November to,
oh my gosh,
to my beautiful wife. So it was quite the time. But you know what? I figured it out. I found a group to go into finance with and grew that, bought it, merged it with another group and grew the combination. Do you know Alexandra Preet? You know,
very well.
So Preet is a very good friend of mine and she's a wonderful person. And I hope she gets to hear this. She's just, you know, really somebody who's so warm and kind. I knew her a little bit during the campaign in 08. And then after we lost, I was sitting with her and another common friend of ours in New York. And she said, you know, we need some people to start going on TV for FoxNews.com, they're called Strategy Room, who are in New York. Would you want to do it? And of course, with me, I always say yes.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
I remember one quick story, you know, having my dad working with a company that worked with Princeton University. The way he got there was we had a family friend, old family friend of ours, who was a very noted scientist, you know, physicist, very noted. And very smart and a great chess player. Okay, and he would have these fun get-togethers for all the brainiacs of Princeton and a lot, especially the Russian Jewish, because a lot of folks, as you can imagine, Princeton University, the brain drain. There's a lot of Russian Jewish immigrants
who like chess.
So I was 13, 14 years old, and this guy, and his name's Victor, and we would be. He said, "You want to play chess?" I said, "Sure, we'll play chess." And we start playing chess, and after about 4 moves, he goes, "Boris, you have no idea how to play, do you?" So I'm figuring it out. Okay? And, you know, the sort of don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness has been a mantra of mine for a long time. So I did the same thing with TV. Sure, I'll go on TV.
Can you play chess now at least?
I'm proficient at chess.
Good.
I'm proficient. I can play pretty well. So
who was Preet working for back then that she asked you to do that stuff for Fox?
I think she had a relationship with Fox.
Oh, with Fox.
And then she knew that they needed more guests.
So you're dropped into TV.
So she dropped into my first appearance ever was I think it was Geraldo Bowling and Kimberly Guilfoyle, right? It was my first thing ever. And then from then on, I started doing it more and more and more and got on Fox and Friends. So that was a direct result of being on McCain. And one I never expected.
What's your label? Were you a GOP strategist?
Exactly.
A McCain? Okay.
GOP strategist, former McCain Palin aide is what they would hire me. And I would go in there and I would pontificate on all kinds of issues. And listen, we've all got opinions and I've got opinions and I have a bearing in history that I'm proud of. And so I would relay that and have a great time. I went on with, before Sally passed away. I went on with Combs. Remember of Hannity and Combs?
Yeah.
He would host, and I went on with them. So it was really an experience. And then and I went. So it was Strategy, which was FoxNews.com. They were sort of a precursor to all the online TV stuff. And then I went on Fox Maine, and I think I did my first Fox and Friends in 09. And so it really grew that the surrogate work or political analyst work from there, the pundit work, and. Obviously, we're still doing it right now, right?
So when do you get back into politics, back into campaigning? What's your next official?
Romney. Well, so I wasn't involved in the primary, but then when Mitt Romney became the nominee, I was a surrogate for the Mitt Romney campaign, and I did the Bill Maher show for the first time then, which was
You got it. You got to talk to us about that. I'm fascinated.
Done it twice.
All right. In the meantime, he's Boris Epstein. Follow him, Boris EP on Twitter, Boris _ Epstein on Instagram, and also
at Boris EP on Getter.
Okay, always remember that. Got to add the Getter. Okay, so did I even know this? Bill Maher, really?
Bill Maher, twice?
You got to tell me about
it. Including since I've known you.
Wow.
First time in 12, I think 2 or 3 weeks before Election Day. And I was on the panel. I was the Republican on the panel.
Who else was on the show?
It was Goldie Taylor, who is a very far left-wing zealot, I guess, let's put it that way, right? And then it was him, and then it was Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone at the time.
Were you trepidatious, or was it just the Baron's gonna do some TV with a lefty?
Gonna go do some TV, gonna go have a good time. maybe one shot of whiskey before starting to fully be, you know,
to
fully get some courage and get it rolling. And it was great. And you know,
how did he treat you?
I've done it twice, and I will say it. Bill's been nothing but a gentleman, been very courteous.
Did it get heated around the table?
Goldie Taylor and I got heated with each other, but he was not heated with me at all. And that was 12. And, you know, I said my points. And it was a little bit of, there was too much talking over each other. It was a little bit too much of that. That was 12. The next time I did was 17 after I left the White House. And he had me on. And it was one-on-one. So I was the top of the show.
Mm.
And I don't know if my folks came with me. So it's great. You know, it's fun.
Did he want you to dish? Is that why he
knew
on?
I would not dish. Okay. It was very clear I wouldn't dish. He pried a little bit. But it was honestly, has a little bit of a tough time getting leading Republicans, folks, right? So it's a show, right? He wants to keep a show going. So he actually kind of, I've had much tougher and much more in-your-face interviews with Chris Bromo, right? Or, or Lawrence O'Donnell, which I've all done. Then, you know, it was kind of, it was pretty straightforward. It was 101. My folks came. They were in the audience.
Were they proud?
They were proud. My dad was nervous.
Yeah?
I mean, you know, because it is sort of the lion's den, right?
Yeah.
But I'd done it before.
What are their politics, if I may ask?
I think as all immigrants who come here and work hard and believe in opportunity and believe in the greatness of America, they are as MAGA as they get.
Right. They trepidatious because this is the lion's den.
And I just started at Sinclair, so there were going to be some questions about Sinclair. And I knew, and listen, with fairness to the show, they told me what the topics were. He stuck to the topics.
Good.
And if you look at the show, there's one kind of funny.
I've got to watch this. I'm going to find these videos and watch them later tonight.
It's a fun clip. So at one point, he says something to me about, you know, Donald Trump. And I said, how was the work for the president? And I said, honestly, that he's authentic, he's kind, he's supportive. He's positive that President Trump is the best boss I've ever worked for. And I felt it then. I feel this way now. I'm sure I'll feel that way until my last breath. I could not be more, and I know you feel this way, same way, could not be more honored and proud to have worked for and to continue to be supportive of supporting Trump. And the crowd kind of booed a little bit. And I looked around and I said, I bet 50% I bet at least 30 or 50% of you voted for Trump. And they all broke out in laughter. It was a nice, easy moment. I did get a good piece of advice going into that show. And I will, whoever's listening and thinking of doing any sort of media work, I think this is something to carry with you. Smile. Somebody said to me, just smile.
Yes.
You know, even though if it's a tough interview, you know it's going to be tough, smile. It will sort of, everybody's a human being. It'll disarm them. So anyway, I know we fast forward a little bit, but that's my Bill Maher story. If anybody
you skipped a bit,
I did. So 12, I was a surrogate for Romney,
right?
And that came out of having done a ton of TV between 08 and 12. I did CNN a ton, MSNBC a ton, Fox a good amount. Obviously, the FoxNews.com. So you know, when it came time for the campaign, I had some good friends who were very senior in the Romney campaign. You know, good Republicans, people who had been in the Republican world. So I helped there. We lost again, so I was 0-2. And then I went back to my business, to the investment banking side.
And then how did you get involved with the winner?
I have to tell you that the best decision I ever made was I never backed another candidate. From the moment that the president ran, and from the moment I could help, I came out. I was a public supporter. Then I became an official surrogate for the campaign, which you sign an agreement to be a surrogate. And then, just as it happens at campaign, just like that, I went from being a guy on the phone calls as one of the surrogates to a guy leading the phone calls. And, honored to say that the president noted and appreciated, I think, some of my work out there. Because, I was one of those folks who went into all the battles, right? So if you look at
That's who you are. If
TV of June, July, August 16, I mean, Kazir Khan, boom, I was there talking about how he's just being a political pawn, which is now proven, by the way, Biden just give Kazir Khan some appointment, right? All those issues, I was right out there defending the president, defending our position, and just like the loyal, supportive boss that he is, he saw through that and gave me the opportunity to advance, and I became a senior advisor overseeing all surrogate messaging, and had the honor of traveling with them, went around the country, opened for him at a rally in 16. I've got a great picture of that from Ohio, and we all know the historic result.
And then he ends up, along with me, in the White House, special assistant to the president. We're talking to Boris Epstein, at Boris EP on Twitter, Boris underscore Epstein on Instagram, and don't forget Getter as well. So, I could do this for hours, because, you know, how many years have I known you?
Gosh,
it's been a while.
Now 5 years?
It's been a while. And I'm learning a lot of stuff. And we've been, you know, friends for that much time. You've been on my show. You've hosted my radio show.
Yes.
We've co-hosted a podcast, and yes. I'm learning stuff, and it's fascinating. So let's pull out. Let's go up to 50,000 feet. Let's talk about the last 5 years. You are a political animal, clearly. You love this country. You have a great... You always bring to our discussion, sooner or later, for just some reason, it's like a geyser bubbling up through the surface. You bring up this historical perspective that is super, super helpful, your love of history. So talk to us about what happened in 2016, according to the Baron, and what is the impact? How much? Because I think Mike Flynn was right when he called 16 a peaceful revolution. How much has politics changed, and what do you expect in the near future in terms of the way it's going to shake out?
I think the Republican Party changed, and likely forever.
Yeah.
Because what went from being a country club Republican Party, you know, funny polo shirt Republican Party,
bow ties, blazers,
is now a populist, nationalist in a good way,
working class,
pro-America Republican Party, and the lines are drawn so clearly
mm-hmm.
between those who stand for the American flag and those who don't, between those who believe there are genders that should be assigned at birth and those who do not, between those who want to fight back against China and those who do not. So the Republican Party has actually enriched itself and grown itself because of President Donald J. Trump.
I'm curious, let me just jump in here. Is this exactly the same? How different is this from what Reagan did? Because Reagan got a lot of blue-collar Democrats on his side. Are we seeing a return to that, or is there something qualitatively different?
It's different in some ways. It's different in that I think Reagan's appeal was that it was a kumbaya appeal. You know, let's all come together, and that's possible. And it was possible at the time.
Bright morning.
It's a beautiful
morning
in America.
Yeah, right.
Let's feel good about each other. Let's come together. And that's how you... And he won 49 states. And actually, I've heard from good sources, 50 states, except, you know, the dead voted in northern Minnesota. Okay?
Again,
right. So, you know, that was...
There's not a lot of kumbaya now.
That was Reagan's right, appeal, and he was right. able to do it. The country's become so divided.
Yeah.
And that divide really started in a big way during the Clinton years.
You think it wasn't Obama?
I think it was the deep divide. Because think about the impeachment at the time, mm-hmm. which actually looking backward, I think probably was not the right, it was not necessary,
not smart
because it led to the cheapening of impeachment that we just saw
yes,
happen,
absolutely.
You know, under the absolutely, you know, devoid of any reality Pelosi. So if you look at what happened there, that the divide started there because the country was very, think about how Bush was vilified. People forget that, how mm-hmm. President Bush,
absolutely.
W. Bush was vilified and they treated him not as bad as they treated Donald Trump, but pretty bad.
Yeah.
Okay?
No, Nazi as well. No, blah, blah, blah.
The whole
war
thing.
Criminal.
War
criminal. Right,
yeah, right. Whole thing. And that didn't happen as much. You know, there was some of that on mm-hmm. the fringe. But now, so the Reagan, there was still an opportunity to truly come together. I think what President Trump did is he brought out of the shadows. It was that, you know, the forgotten man and woman.
Yes.
Right? The silent majority.
Betrayed by both sides of the swamp.
Betrayed by the uniparty. Right?
Yeah.
Betrayed by the uniparty. Yeah. All they care about is going along to get along, and if, you know, it's better to deal with China, let's deal with China. President Trump brought people from Alabama to northern Michigan and all, you know, to Oregon and Washington and all in the middle. He brought them out and said, I'm your guy. That's what it is. It was the ability and you know, people love you, of a billionaire, of a blue-collar billionaire to say, I'm your guy, believe in me as I believe in you, and let's go together and let's gain power back in this country. And that happened in 16, and then I think the swamp bit back and stole the election in 2020.
I've said this on the radio show, and I want to say it again for those who are tuning in for the first time. For me, the pivotal moment when he won the election was that rally, or maybe the RNC convention. I think he said it before the convention when he said, what's her slogan? Oh, I'm with her.
Right.
Do you know what mine is?
I'm with you.
I mean, that ultimate jujitsu of the cult worshipping the nominee on the left in Hillary, vice the man who says, I'm just here for you guys. That was like, deal, done, he's won.
I think he, as was expected, the Donald Trump, the man that Americans knew for a long time, went out there and said, just as you pointed out, I am with you. Yeah. I'm with the American people. I don't need this. You know, it is not my life's goal.
I'm famous already, thank you. I'm rich and famous.
I'm cool. Look at my life, okay? I'm cool. But I'm doing this for you because I believe in my country. I cannot stand the Iran deal as an example. I'm doing this. And I think in a lot of ways that is reminiscent of a Teddy Roosevelt. You know, somebody who really was larger than life, loves this country. And, you know, somebody asked me recently, you know, who is the heir apparent in the MAGA movement? And obviously, you know, it makes sense to say Don Jr. is a potential heir apparent. But if you look at the larger than life figures in American history, I guess there's the guys who are bubbling up, right, of the history. Look at Lincoln. Look at Teddy Roosevelt. Look at FDR.
Right?
And then, you know, in some ways, LBJ, I think Kennedy's tough to say because it was so short.
Yep.
And LBJ and Reagan, there's never been really a logical heir apparent. If you look at all of them, there was nobody who grabbed the mantle and said,
that's fascinating.
Right? I'm next.
Yeah, each one of them was their own man.
Was the very much
and represented their own thing.
Right. And then what came after, in some ways, was a redux to the future, to the past. Otherwise, it was into the future. But it was not, I am now Lincoln number two, or Teddy Roosevelt number two, or Ian Reagan. H.W. Bush won that 88 election 1,000% off the back of Ronald Reagan. But
totally.
But H.W. Bush was not. And yeah, if anything, Jack Kemp, who was up against H.W. for that primary, he was the more logical heir apparent.
Totally.
To Ronald Reagan.
I mean, let's be honest, as far as I'm concerned, he was a bureaucrat. There's no senior Bush brand. You don't think Bushism, right?
And remember, there was a bitter primary in '80 between the two of them.
Very good.
Famous New Hampshire, I paid for this mic, right?
Right.
So that's all very real. So again, I think as we look at this time, and we are so lucky that President Trump continues to be the leader of the Republican Party, the MAGA movement, and in a large way, this country, we need to be appreciative of having this larger-than-life leader in our historic moment.
So, you've made general comments about the future. Let's get a little bit more specific. And it's one of the things. So you've got a great brand now. I love having you on the show. I've caught you a couple of times recently. You're a regular guest almost every day with Steve Bannon on his War Room. And you got to catch him there. Boris is great on the War Room. The swamp, the establishment. What's going to happen? I tweeted something out yesterday, got a lot of likes and retweets, that if he runs, he wins, I think.
Yes.
If he wins, it's got to be radical. It's got to be even more radical than it was for the last 4 years.
Correct.
I said, move the DOD to Wyoming, move the State Department to Kansas. You've got to drain the swamp, get rid of the EPA, get rid of the Department of Education. And that's just the bureaucratic deep state that I witnessed, that you witnessed in the White House. You are right that there is an indelible change in conservative politics because there is a MAGA base, there is an America First brand. I look at the January 6th Select Committee, I still see a GOP establishment that either doesn't understand what happened in 2016 or is truly convinced it is a blip, an anomaly, and it's back to business, mutual back scratching with the Democrats. What is your balance sheet of the establishment conservative establishment, and what can be or should be done about it?
It's all about the elections. We've got to elect MAGA candidates in 2022.
Yeah.
Because no matter how much we think that, you know, the establishment, the rhinos are with us, you look at what happens, right? And then you've got Mitch McConnell, who's a stone-cold killer. All of a sudden, January 6th, completely misplays his hand, goes all in against President Trump, thinking, oh, Trump's done.
Yeah.
Trump's done. And there was that, like, 72-hour period, right, after January. Mm-hmm. We've got rid of him. Wrong. Wrong.
But so many people said that.
Right.
He's done.
Right.
And I said, Max, he's got to draw back a little bit.
Right.
But then the second impeachment comes, and it's like,
boom.
Nancy, how dumb are you?
Completely played into our hands, in President Trump's hand. So my balance sheet is that we have got to elect MAGA conservatives, MAGA Republicans.
But when you say we, it's not you and me that...
No, it's we Americans.
It's not you and I that organize that. The GOP is the machine. So how do we fight the machine that has the money, that has the local offices, that we can say, yeah, we want MAGA candidates, but there's this thing in between us and the MAGA candidates called the RNC.
Well, in some ways, you know, both you and I, for example, look at Missouri. I'm helping your endorsed Eric Greitens, right? That is a candidate who the establishment is not a big fan of, right? And that is how we, and for those, that's how impacted. For people at home, you support financially, you support publicly, you support these candidates. And it's been proven time. Go back to 2010 with a lot of the old establishment Republicans lost and were taken out by the Tea Party, by Eric Cantor and others. That is what happens when the movement comes out, and the movement is still able to make a huge difference in this country, a huge difference. And I think that's going to continue to happen. And we, who humbly the leaders of this movement, obviously all, you know, under the leadership of President Trump, we've got to keep pushing it. Because if we stay silent, if we buy into the establishment, that's when we lose.
Are we witnessing right now a Tea Party 2.0? Is it that simple? Is it that big?
I think it's the way I would put it is that Tea Party was a precursor to MAGA.
Yes.
I don't think I think MAGA is bigger than the Tea Party. I think the MAGA movement, I mean, first of all, the Tea Party never elected a president.
Yeah.
Right? MAGA.
Yeah.
President Trump is MAGA. Second of all, the breadth of the change to the party, I think, outstrips what happened in 2010.
One issue I have is we don't have a Newt Gingrich. We don't have that 80-pound brain on the right. And one of the big frailties of the last 4 years is we have this movement, we have this very simple idea. Sovereignty, borders, prosperity, safety, got it. Beautiful. But there is a lot of heavy lifting that needs to be done intellectually to make a movement stable. This happened after Reagan. There was a flowering of think tanks and writers and magazines and what have you. We don't have that. We've got the odd thing here and there. You know, the Claremont Institute has its great publication, The Review of Books. American Greatness, the website, superb. Are we not missing the big ideological heavy lifting and the people who could do that for us? Because we've got the leader, we've got the embodiment, we've got the grundoons, as Steve says. But what about the intellectual work? Is it being done?
It's interesting. What I would say to that is that we're in a different time, especially with social media, is that it's less necessary now.
Interesting.
And then I think it's the grundoons, they call it, the MAGA posse, who are themselves smart and plugged in and read. And they are, and the work, as you know, supposed to happen with populism, is the work is being done at that level.
I like that.
And not by, you know, 80-pound brains sitting around and then going to a nice lunch, which you and I both enjoy, right? But it's the people on whose behalf this is being done and by whom this is being fought who are doing the thinking and pushing the movement forward. And, hey, with that, sometimes you'll have some people who are in the extreme and say things that we absolutely do not agree with, right? But what also comes with it is an authenticity. That it's not a thought process that's being imposed on the so-called,
It's not an elite definition.
It's not top down. It's down up.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
You know, and I think, or it's flat, and I think that's wonderful.
Well, that's very interesting because a lot of people talk about that in the private sector. That's how you get things done there. It's got to be flat, not hierarchical. Amazing discussion. We can do hours more on this. We will find time to do so. Very pleasurable for me. What we're doing with these one-on-ones, at the end, I ask everybody, is there something you'd like to say? Is there something that people should be thinking more about? Is there a message you wish to send out there? Boris, the floor is yours.
Well, as always, first I'd like to say is I'm so thankful to my parents. And I know that's not what a lot of folks will say. First thing I want to say is I'm so thankful to my parents for having the unbelievable courage to, in their mid-30s, with aging parents of their own, and a chubby little kid in his, who's 11 years old, just becoming a teen, to pick up from their homeland and say, we're going to the beauty and opportunity of America. And not to just come here, but come here and not accept. A lot of folks, and I'm sure a lot of folks come from the former Soviet Union. They get to Brooklyn and they sort of settle in and they don't push, right? They, and they work hard, but they don't try for that, for the next level and next level and next level. And I'm so thankful that my parents did that, are doing that, and have instilled that in me. I'm, obviously thankful and all, I was just recently working on a potential book idea and wrote in the proposal sort of describing who I am as a son, a husband, a father, and forever a grandson. And, because I think a lot of my grandparents and, what they went through in living through World War II and my grandfather fighting, the Nazis and my grandmother being, she worked in factories. She had to evacuate to, Siberia, work in factories. She worked in a bomb factory with her cousin. They had a fire. She ran out. Her cousin ran back in. That's it, and died in front of her, right? And just those things that you read about in books, but our families have experienced, So I'm so thankful and honored by that. And then, to folks out there, here's what I'll say. Always stay in the fight. Because if you back down, if you say enough is enough, that is when they win. That is when those who are not willing to stand up to China, that's when those who don't want to stand for our flag, that's when those who want to get rid of the nuclear family, that's when they win. Stand for what you believe in and stand proudly for what you believe in. Because if you do not, the other side will beat you down. They will wear you down. They will grind you down. Stand up for what you believe in. Stand up proudly. Stand up strongly. And we will absolutely prevail because history is on our side.
Wow. He brings it every single time. I'm going to tweet that out. I'm going to quote the Baron, when you stop fighting, they win. That's all you need to know. We have already won because we will not stop fighting. Thank you, Boris.
Thanks so much. God bless you.